continue recording. So hymenoptera are by and large beneficial insects. And say there are parasitoids and, you know, species that are predators, but there is just the one suborder, and I say suborder in quotes, the symphyta, which are largely, you know, plant feeding, and some of those are damaging. But most hymenoptera fall on the positive side.
Why suborder in quotes?
Because the old, we'll actually get to it. It'll happen. We'll actually talk about this in a little while yet today. But I can jump ahead somewhat and say basically is in the old days, hymenoptera was separated into two suborders, the symphyta, which was the plant-feeding sawflies, and the apocrida, which are everything else. And what we now know is the apocrida is a good monophyletic group. And what the term monophyletic means, there's sort of two terms here, and maybe this will help clarify some terms, is monophyletic means a group that they all share a common ancestor. Mm-hmm. If a group is holophyletic, it includes all descendants of a common ancestor. And so that leaves our third term, paraphyletic, which means we either have a group that has more than one common ancestor, or our group isn't including all the descendants. So does that make those three terms now clear? Mm-hmm. So anyway, the gist of all this is it's turned out that we now know that Apocrida is a monophyletic group, but Symphyta is more of a grade rather than a clade, as they say. And I'm sure Dave talked about grades and clades. But okay, back at the Orthoptera. The orthopteroid orders are more a grade than a clade, whereas the hemipteroid orders are a clade.
Clade makes sense. I don't know what grade is.
Grade means we're the trunk of a tree with many branches. Mm-hmm. You know.
That's grade.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so all the orthopteroid orders, there's some groups that are more related to each other than others, but they're all branching off a main trunk. Mm-hmm. There's no one branch that says orthopteroid orders. Like there is hemipteroid orders, like there is neuropteroid orders.
That explains. Okay.
So that's grade versus clade. And so symphyta are a grade rather than a clade. And there's one family of symphyta called the Orusidae, which we actually aren't covering, O-R-U-S-S-I-D-A-E, that is the sister group to all the Apocrida. Let's see. Now, if we start looking at characters, and this will be a little detailed thing of characters, because these are just the kind of things that are going to come up. See, now we're in focus. We've got it working. So, to start with head characters, what keys ask for is if you look at the antennae, if you remember the scape, the basal segment, pedicel, one beyond, and then the whole thing would be the flagellum. And if you break it down further, club and radicula, I should say, is that little, right at the very base of the scape, there's an area that can sometimes be sclerotized. And then the funicle is all those segments between the pedicel and the club. And there's some keys, Burke key sometimes asks the number of funicular segments. And so that's why antennae, especially with the chalcedoids, are important. Okay. And in terms of head characters, things that will come up, especially maybe with bees, is there's a thing called facial fovea, which are just patches like velvet. It will be on the heads of some creatures. The size of the genus, or whether it has a crease in the edge, is sometimes important for identifying things. And the occipital carina, then at the end of there would be the gena, and then the occipital carina. Mm-hmm. All on the handout. Or the, say, subantennal suture, that's very often asked in different groups as to the core, where it is and the course of it, or whether there's one or two of them. And then sometimes the malar space, the difference between the eyes and the end of the head, or say just general clypeus. And then labrum would be right below it, I'm sure. There's got to be a...
There's
got to be a labrum picture somewhere there, and that's...
Maybe it's
on the next one. Let's see. Is it on the next one? Okay, yeah. Now, and so we'll go to the next. Other characters with mouth parts. There's labrum on that one. Shit, I wish it would have been on the last one. Now, what often happens, and it's major, I guess it's a major thing in bees, they talk about long-tongued bees and short-tongued bees. And identifying it, there's two interpretations of that. And we'll sort of use both of them, but the short-tongued bees, the way it's used in the book, specifically refers to the glossa, whether it's very short and sometimes bilobed or just broad at the end, versus a long-tongued bee that has a really long glossa. That's in the key in your book. Now, the other way it's interpreted, and it's the way the bee keys interpret it, is they look at the segments of the labial palpi. And in a, let's see if we have one that shows it really well. In a short-tongued bee, here's a long-tongued bee. Here is the labial palpi, the basal two segments, are longer than the last two. And in a short-tongued bee, all the labial palpal segments are about the same length. So there's two different interpretations. The bee keys use that second interpretation, length of the labial palpi, although that's mentioned in the book. But the book, in the book key, it uses the length of the glossa and whether it's bifid or not.
So both of the thing, both of those, the one that you referred to and the one below it, are a long-tongued bee?
Let's see. There's something going on with this diagram, and I'm
not sure.
Not sure what, but I think's going on is there are the labial palpi here, mm-hmm. sticking up, and they're all short little segments. And this is the maxillary palp.
Okay.
On the diagram.
Okay.
So basically, yeah, the long tongue bee is either long glossa versus short glossa, or the other way to talk about it is long tongue bee has two basal segments of the labial palp long and the latter two short. And then a short tongue bee has all the segments of the labial palpi of the same length.
Okay.
So we'll get through. And wing venation characters that the book asks or that matter in identifying, is first thing is whether cells are closed versus opened. And I don't know if that's been talked about before.
Mm-hmm.
Closed cell is surrounded by veins. Open cell is one that is contiguous with the wing margin.
A couple insects have really only closed cells.
Yep. That's in here. In Hymenoptera, there's some of every combination.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing is the stigma, which is a little thickened area on the anterior edge of the wing. The structure of that, the size of it, how, you know, is a thing that often comes into play. the stuff of other one that really comes into play is the jugal lobe versus the length of this submarginal cell, or this submedian cell, excuse me.
You said submarginal
cell? Submedian is what I meant to say. This cell. There's the jugal lobe, and this would be the venal lobe, and this submedian cell, the length of that jugal lobe versus the length of that cell is a thing that really matters in the keys for identifying. It matters in the bees, and it matters in some of the wasp groups. Here they're calling it the clavel lobe. In other places they call it the venal lobe. And there's the hamulli. And you can see, with your scopes, you can see them pretty easily on any good-sized bee. Mm-hmm. If the wings are uncoupled, that's easy to see.
So the hamulli are the coupling mechanisms?
Yeah, the little hooks.
Hooks.
Yeah. And we'll meet them again in the Trichoptera, and we'll meet them yet one more time in one family of Lepidoptera. What's that?
In one family of Lepidoptera?
Yeah, one family of Lepidoptera has hamulli.
Oh,
right. And it's, when you get to it, I get to say it, it's the family you'd expect to find them in.
Oh.
Okay, a lot of this, I was going to look to see what things really need to be said. And a lot of this you can just look. I'm going to find there's one of these handouts that matters more than. Okay, there's the one that matters.
Okay.
Okay. Thoracic characters, handout two, is the shape of the pronotum is critically important in any hymenoptera. In fact, it might be, until you get to the point where you just start recognizing families, it might be the very first thing you want to look at. Is what you want to observe is its shape at the top. Is it, you know, is its dorsal margin straight or arcuate, arched, you know, or maybe V-shaped?
Uh-huh.
You know, that dorsal margin shape. In lateral view, does it look quadrate, or is it more triangular in shape? Or does it have a lobe on lateral? And then the other thing that matters is whether the say pronotum comes close to, there's a structure called the tegula, which is a scale-like structure at the very base of the wing. Mm-hmm. And it covers the base. It's usually brown and shiny, but it'll vary in different groups, but it's a little glossy. It looks like a little cup-shaped structure that covers the very base of the wing. And the question often comes up in the key is, does the pronotum touch or nearly touch the tegula?
If yes, it's somewhere in this area. If no, mm-hmm. It's somewhere.
And that's a real crucial thing in keys. So getting acquainted with the structures of the pronotum is probably the most, the single thing that will help you most in identifying Hymenoptera. And I just look at, there's a lot of structure things here that are just good for reference. And so I'm just going to continue, let's see. We'll have to stop at this slide, which is wing venation. No, we're not going to make anybody recite these detailed wing venations. That's, wouldn't do that to anybody, because that defeats the purpose. The only idea is there's the point of any of this is that you need to have a terminology to, you know, in the keys to understand things. And so using, this is the modern terminology, which is, but sometimes some of the keys and, you know, sometimes use older terminologies, and they're both in your handouts. But say this is called the median vein. And often in your book and in other handouts, it'll be called the basal vein. I'm just, for the record, I'm referring to the picture of a wasp wing rather than the sawfly wing on the Hymenoptera wings identification characters sheet. And there's the three cells. This cell, at the end of the stigma, there's a cell on the wing margin, called the marginal cell. The shape of that is often important. In fact, I just used that to determine the other day that I didn't have a rare bee. then right below the submarginal cell, right below the marginal cell, there are three additional cells. It varies in number, 1 to 3. And they're called submarginal cells. And their presence or their shape really matters. The area between the costal vein and the radial vein is this, that happens to have the subcostal vein in it on this diagram, but the area between the costa and radial vein, that cell, is called a costal cell, and its presence or absence matters. The only other venation thing I'm going to talk about is we have the M1CU cross vein and the 2MCU cross vein. They're often called recurrent veins. First recurrent vein, second recurrent vein, which is the easier way to remember them. But those veins, the presence of one or the other of those matters. And that's the venation characters that really come into play. So seeing the whole terminology is helpful, but just knowing those things will get the identification done. And let's see. I guess I need to... Let's see. Before I go to the Hymenoptera families, the only other thing I'll mention is I guess there is one thing about the legs that should be mentioned, and that is, it's in your handouts, but it's just Hymenoptera have one or two trochanters. Mm-hmm. Coxa trochanter, femur, tibia, tarsus are the basic leg segments. But the trochanter in Hymenoptera, some families have two trochanters, and the second one is sometimes termed the trochantella.
Don't stop.
What's that?
Right back,
okay.
Hello?
Well, he's taking the phone call. Do you have any questions? Because if I turn off the recorder, it'll make a second file, and I don't want to do that. Oh, well, it's fire.
So, let's see, the recurring vein, is that also called like the medial cubital vein, or?
Let's put that back up. There.
Yeah, the 2M-CU.
Yeah, 2MC is, see, this is cubital, and this is median. And so that's why it gets the cross veins take the name of the vein below and the vein above. So that's where those names come from. But it's easier to think of them as, since what you don't see here is, it's Hymenoptera have such a derived venation that it's easier, the older system is sort of easier to use, calling things recurrent veins. As opposed to properly, this is the M1CU cross vein. It is the 2MCU cross vein. But first recurrent vein, second recurrent vein. And the book uses those terms too interchangeably. what's happened with our textbook is it goes through a number of iterations over the years. And as things change, at every single step in those changes, they didn't update every single place in the text. So Dave's back when Dave was at LSU, one of the people he worked with, Joan Chapin, who was the curator of the lab down there, sat down and, according to Dave, went through this textbook that you guys are using and brought everything up to date for that time period. And then they didn't use her changes. They'd given it to her, a text copy to review, you know, before the printing of, I guess it would be two editions ago now. And she went through it meticulously, because she was a very meticulous person, and went through everything and brought all the nomenclature, so it's all standard throughout. And then they didn't incorporate it. So in other words, so when you look at the book, your textbook, sometimes it'll say recurrent veins, sometimes it'll say first MCU cross vein. So. And other things and characters we'll sort of get to as we get there. So what I thought I'd do is we'll just start getting through some of the families, and so we'll start with the suborder Symphyta that isn't the suborder, as we already sort of covered. It's a grade, not a clade. But there's still characters that I'm just going to put that distinguish them as a group. And the major one of those is that the abdomen is broadly joined to the thorax. Now the other condition, and this maybe goes into some more terminology in Hymenoptera, is the other condition, which is in the Apocrida, is the first abdominal segment is actually pushed forward and joined with the thorax. And then the second abdominal segment is joined to that first by a narrow connection called the petiole. Yeah, which is the, you know, the very base of the second abdominal segment.
Okay.
That's what it would be in the Apocrida. Whereas here in Symphyta, like say, abdomen is broadly joined to the thorax. And so what that means, in typical, you know, except for the Symphyta, in typical Hymenoptera, you can't say head, thorax, abdomen, because that first abdominal segment has been incorporated into the thorax. So you say head, mesosoma, metasoma. And some people, we usually with ants, instead of metasoma, they'll use the term gaster. But so anyway, in the sawflies, the abdomen is broadly joined. The thorax. Another characteristic is that the hind wings in sawflies always have at least three closed cells. That number varies in the Apocrida, you know, usually one or two, it's often, you know, very often zero. If you go strictly by species numbers. But sawflies always have three closed cells.
Within the hind wings?
On the hind wings, yeah. But the exception to that is there's one particular species of wood wasp, Cirrus, which we'll talk about when we get there. they're really distinctive in other ways, so it's never a problem. And the trochanters are always two segmented. And as we mentioned, these groups are foliage feeders. Some are wood boring, but most of them are foliage feeding on deciduous or coniferous. And that's sort of where you get the suborder name, Symphyta. Symph is together, phyta, plant. So together plant feeding is kind of the derivation of the suborder name. Now when we do that, we can sort of, for the group itself, we can divide the sawflies just for identification purposes into two groups. The first group, the two groups is based on the number of spines on the at the end of the front tibia. Or I should say spurs, not spines, spurs, because they're movable, So the first group of families we'll cover are those that have two apical spurs on the foretibia. And I put the Xylinidae, we happen to have the slide, and there's a little write-up in Dave's notes, so I'll just put it up there to show it to you, but this isn't the required family. And the superfamily has changed, as you can tell. But if you happen to see one, they're really readily identifiable by that third antennal segment being really long. And see, the adults are found early in the spring on feeding on catkins or willows and things. And then the larvae are foliage feeders. So we'll just speed through that and go to the next family, and we're still in our two anterior tibial spurs group, and I didn't get all, I tried to erase all those to start fresh, but anyway, the Symphysidae are the Symphysid sawflies. There's only 12 species that tend to be pretty large. They're almost thumb size. Very robust sawflies. The antennae are always clubbed. And the antennae have seven or fewer segments. And a really well-known species is called the elm sawfly. In fact, that's a fun one to look up, and you can see it's the larva that's most frequently confused with Lepidoptera larva. But it's caterpillar-like, which means it's an erusiform larvae. I don't know if they've given you that term yet. E-R-U-C-I-F-O-R-M. Erusiform larvae. And they're like a Lepidoptera larvae, but they have more. Lepidoptera larvae only have at most five pairs of prolegs, and sawfly larvae always have more pairs of prolegs, or they don't have any. Prolegs are the little, when you see caterpillar walk, the little sucker-like feet underneath. On caterpillars, they have little rings of spines on the bottom of each proleg called crochets that are little hook-like things. That
the pseudopoda?
You wouldn't call them pseudopoda. The term that's used is proleg, mm-hmm. And then the spines are called crochets.
I remember that was on one of the tests that I remember two of them didn't get, and the reason I got is because I remember that was brought in the entomology class before that.
Anybody you guys ever seen elm sawfly or the larvae? I mean, it's a bright greenish or yellow larvae with a black stripe down the middle of the back. They're really conspicuous, and they Yeah.
Like a caterpillar.
Yeah, it does, and everybody mistakes it on LEP pages on the internet. What kind of caterpillar is this? I can't find it anywhere.
Well,
it's not a caterpillar.
Start looking for a caterpillar.
Yeah, exactly. But what they have is, by the way, you can maybe tell when these handouts were made, I made them specifically so they would work for two different classes, for this class and for immature insects. Mm-hmm. That's why both adults and larvae are on most sheets. But there's additional larval ones for immature insects. The point that I want to bring up with the caterpillar is, if you look at the spiracles on these guys, they're called winged. They have a little trough that they sit in that's triangular. Mm-hmm. And at the top of that, there's a little gland that if you upset them, they will squirt a compound, which I haven't looked into just what the basis of that is, but it's probably some of the same chemical that's in elm leaves. I don't know if you've noticed, elm leaves have a very distinctive smell.
I haven't sniffed elm leaves.
I know, it's not a thing that people normally do, but the only reason I noticed it ever was because elm leaf beetles, if you've ever seen an outbreak of elm leaf beetles, they're like concentrated elm leaf smell. And it's a deterrent for predators.
So they kind of just sequester the volatiles?
Yeah, most likely. And these, like, they're the same type of thing. And there's other species that do feed on, this is elm sulfides on elm, but other species on willow and on birch. And there's only 12 species in North America, and so far as we know, only the elm sulfly in North Dakota.
As far as we know.
Yes. And we'll get to the next one, which is the Diprionidae. And conifer sulfites, the azar ones for the larvae, do feed on conifers. And they're often gregarious on conifers. And it's another one of those things. They concentrate the terpenes and things from the conifers. And when there's an infestation, you can smell it when you're when you're near them. In fact, I've had occasions where I've smelled the larvae before I found it.
Does it smell like Christmas?
I never thought of it that way. Because it has a more rancid tinge to it. It's not just conifer terpenes. But anyway, for identifying these guys, is males have pectinate antennae. They can either be unipectinate or bipectinate. And then the females have serrate antennae. And the antennae, there are always 13 or more segments. And this is a little bigger group with about 45 North American species. Did you find something?
I just Google pictures of things just to see what that looks like. The
larvae of these guys are actually, for sulfly larvae, they're green and black patterns, some are black and yellow, some of them even look like swallowtail caterpillars a little bit. And that gets us to the biggest family of sulflies.
You can tell because it has is common.
Yes, common sulflies. We gave that away, didn't we? Tenthardinidae. And there's over 5,000 species in this group, about 800 in North America. And they have filiform antennae. But it's usually 9 segmented, but it can be anywhere from 7 to 10 segments. And the females have a real cell-like ovipositor. And larvae are usually, but not always, external feeders on foliage of deciduous trees. There's some that are stem borers. And that's the... And that concludes the ones with... two spurs. Now for the single apical spur, the single, those soft flies that have only, with the protibia having only a single apical spur, again we've got three families, and the first of those is the Cephidae, which are the stem soft flies. And these are usually, you know, see, they're usually small, and they're laterally compressed a bit. And you know, almost all of them are patterned in black and yellow, as you can see from the black and white pictures. Now, a good character that for distinguishing them is the pronotum. You can kind of see it in this illustration, is that pronotum is quadrate in dorsal view, and it varies a little bit, but it's either straight or arcuate. But the idea is that it's almost as long as it is wide, or it's even longer than it is wide, the pronotum in dorsal view. And one of the real common economic species is the wheat stem sawfly. And it lives in wheat stems. And it'll hollow out the stalk. And then in the autumn it goes down to ground level and seals off a little silken area and pupates and overwinters in wheat stalks. That's what causes, they've hollowed the stalk, that's what causes lodging and grain loss. Oh, he didn't put that in there. Okay, there is 13 species in North America of cephids. Okay. So I just have two more families to cover, and then I'll be done. And the first of these are the Sericidae. In fact, I only really need to cover this one. Sericidae or horntails. And these are usually fairly large species. The pronotum is almost barbell shaped in dorsal view. It's narrow in the middle, broad on the edges, and it's easily much wider than it is long. And when you look at a sericid sawfly, it looks like they have power shoulders, you know. And this is the one group that doesn't have the three closed cells on the hind wing, but they're very distinctive. And females have a blade-like structure above the ovipositor. And in males, just that last abdominal tergite is expanded and long. And larvae of sericids are wood-boring. Let's see if there's anything else there. In North Dakota, there's about 7 species. I don't see, Dave didn't put North American numbers, but I just happen to know from my work that there's 7 species in North Dakota. And with that, there is one other family we have a handout for, but it's not a required family.
Okay.
And so we'll just call it there so we can have time to get from point A to point B.
I need a few more calls to make.
I think it's warm in here with that on.
It's nice and toasty. I don't like that.
And you're in North Dakota. No.
Yeah.
Let's see. I better do.